We're going to start out with a public hearing on House Bill 2449. And Jamie, if you could give us an overview on this 911 tax?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. We have this measure increases the taxes for emergency communication or the 911 tax to $1.25 per month or per transaction for the pay-as-you-go phones. The first year would be a dollar, and then the second year would be $1.25. It's currently at $0.75. And has remained unupdated for a while, and it also extends the sunset from 2022 to 2030, and specifies that the interest earned by the emergency communications account must be credited to the 911 subaccount, and it adjusts administrative fees accordingly.
Do we have even more simpler layman's terms than that, like what this does to the cell phone bill?
Yeah. So on all our cell phone bills, even if you have a pay-as-you-go phone, you will see a 75-cent charge normally on your bill. It's not assessed per... so if you have a $100 cell phone bill or $75 cell phone bill or $20 cell phone bill, you'd still see the same 75 cents. And so this bill would take that 75 cents and move it to a dollar. And then that would move that to $1.25 in the subsequent year.
Okay. Rep. Findley is here to testify on this. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. I will be brief because it's a long day. For the record, my name is Lynn Findley. I'm the state representative from House District 60, covering Malheur, Harney, Grant, Baker, and part of Lake County. And Chair Hass, members of the committee, I'm here to thank you for having this public hearing today. This has been a long, long, protracted issue to get this resolved. House Bill 2449 addresses the funding of public safety answering points, or commonly referred to as 911 centers. In 1994, a rate of 75 cents per phone line was assessed, and that has been the constant rate since that time. It is not raised. The only thing that has occurred is that in about 2014, 2015, burner phones were added, so all landlines, cell phones, and burner phones are all assessed at 75 cents per month. So we did a study. There's been lots of studies done by the Office of Emergency Management, and it appeared to me that about the total need for operation of the public safety answering points, whether it's a county sheriff-ran facility, or city police, or local taxing district, total cost of that is about $145 million a year. That seems like a lot of money. There are currently 42 of those centers throughout the state. The cost of operation of those centers is incredible. There are components of those centers that are centrally funded. Well, the Office of Emergency Management pays for the trunk lines, some of the data sharing equipment, some of the upgraded 911, enhanced 911 stuff. The difference between 1994, when this fund was established, and now is the difference between a horse-drawn carriage and a Ferrari. I mean, in 1994, when you received a call in a 911 center, they got their notebook out and a clipboard and wrote down the stuff that you got. Tried to figure out where the caller was at. Now, the caller can either immediately display the images on the screen, tell them where they are, their exact coordinates, and who they are, probably. And we're working on implementing the enhanced 911, which will have ability for text in and text out, and a lot of capability. Every member in this building has a public safety entering point that serves their home. A majority of these facilities are organized aligned with the county sheriff's department, but some are attached to the city police department. Regardless of the organizational placement, the responsibilities of the PSAPs are the same: receive and respond to public requests for help. The background of the 911 we talked about, it's been 75 cents since 1995, and In our analysis, it appears that the local unit, whether it's the county sheriff, and in most cases it is, or the city police, they're paying 75% of that cost out of their budget. When we first started talking about raising this tax, we were going to double it from current 75 cents to $1.50. And I received incredible support from every corner of the state, as well as through the middle of the state. Most of the sheriffs and police chiefs told me it will give them the ability to increase their capability, because their budget that funds the 911 center first, and if there's stuff left over, they'll fund patrol deputies or jailers or other support staff. This will immediately free up some of those resources and increase their capability, because the costs continue to go up at a fairly good rate. Some of the reason for that is the increase in equipment, the increased capability. So 20 years ago, there were 200 911 centers. Today, there's 42. Is that the correct number? Probably. It's still a little bit high, and there's continued effort to reduce those numbers and gain efficiencies. The 911 call volume has increased 36.8% since 2010. An example, you recall about a month and a half ago, there was a fire at Wilsonville on apartment structures. Estimates are that 911 center received over 1,000 calls that night. Some of the representatives in this building received calls from constituents who are upset because they called and they've got a busy signal. We don't have quite enough capacity to deal with increased large incidents like that. The 911 surcharge revenue has only increased 1.3% since 2010. It's not keeping up. It's eating more of the local unit's budget and less of the state budget. The breakdown has been many factors have addressed the cost for PSAP operations. There's three funds in this, the three dedicated state fund. The first one is 36% goes out, 1% of that fund to each county. That's a fixed number. 35% goes to counties on a per capita share. So the counties with the largest population gets a much higher than a small population. And then 30% is kept held in the Department of Office of Emergency Management for centrally procured equipment, such as consoles, the contract with CenturyLink for to provide the trunk line service, the enhanced 911 capability. All of those are held centrally. We've had a lot of discussion about this bill. It went to the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee. They've developed a task force. They studied it. They had two or three meetings. And there was pushback from some sectors that they didn't like the tax because it thought it was too aggressive. So after a while, we dropped the tax from 75 cents one time to 50 cents spread over 2 years, with the desire to really study the prior work done on consolidation and enhanced operations. I'm happy to say that the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee sent it off to the Revenue Committee. The Revenue Committee sent it off to the House floor. It passed the House floor with broad bipartisan support, and it's before you today. It's a significant impact for all the cities. I mean, I've never seen anything as unifying as this. And here I am, I'm a fairly conservative Republican, and on the front page of a paper in my district, Finley's doubling 911 tax. And I'm thinking, boy, this is not going to play well. I did not receive an unfavorable comment about that. In fact, I received favorable comments about we really need this help to fund the center.
See what happens when you raise taxes?
I was kind of shocked. And a quote from a city manager from John Day, when he called in, he ended his conversation, "Please raise my taxes." The John Day Center is barely hanging on by their teeth. Most of the Eastern Oregon centers are, and they've done about all the efficiencies they can gain. This is an incredible public safety need that we should meet. I was told when I started this I was crazy. I realize that is a true statement. Had I known all the tussles and hustles that we went through, I probably wouldn't have wanted to do this. But it's very gratifying to see all the support from all the law enforcement and public safety folks. This is a great program. These monies are spent very well, and this will go a long ways in helping them. An example is, why does Grant County have a 911 center? The population, 7,200 people this time of year. In November, in September through November, it's 15,000 people. All the people down there hunting, and when they dial 911, they expect somebody to answer and expect to know what's going on. So we have to have similar capability. These, some of the smaller centers have, they provide a great service. So I'm kind of drugging on a little bit. So,
okay.
But this is a great program. I appreciate your support, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate your work on this.
Thank you. I think there's some great folks behind me that can fill in the blanks. Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
Can I bring my friends?
Yeah, bring your team.
Thank you, Chair House, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hasina Wittenberg. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon chapters of APCO NENA, which represents the 43 public safety answering points statewide. As represented in support of House Bill 2449, be engrossed. As Representative Finley has given an overview of the tax, I do want to make it clear that this tax has been in existence since 1981. It started as a 3% surcharge on subscribers' phone bills. It was then increased in 1991 to a 5% surcharge. It is a recognition for enhanced 911, where a caller could make a call and the call taker would know where that caller was located. In 1995, we changed that funding formula from 5% to 75 cents just so we could have more stability in what we were collecting, so we would know better how to predict and how to budget. And then in 2015, as Representative Finley indicated, prepaid 911 cell phones, or as he affectionately refers to them as burner phones, were also added to the tax. This tax is essential to fund the entire 911 system. On average, a 911 center's budget is made up of 30% of this 911 tax, and the rest of the funds come from user fees, local option levies, or permanent property tax rates. So that's why it's very important to our public safety providers, who are also here with me today to testify in support of this bill. As Representative Finley indicated, this has been a really long, hard set of discussions and deliberations, but ultimately we believe this bill will provide stability for the 911 funding system for several years, with the extension of the 911 tax sunset by 8 years, and an increase of 25 cents in the first year and another increase in 25 cents of the next year. So I'd urge your support of the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and I'm here today testifying in support of House Bill 2449B on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. You've heard it kind of loud and clear. It takes user fees from law enforcement, from fire and EMS, to help support the public safety answering point systems around the state. There's been no increase to this tax, and just to give you an example, in my county, each year the increase to support our portion of the PSAP is equal to about a deputy position. That's how much the increase is. As you know, in Marion County, we have some resources, but around the state, resources are a lot less, especially for public safety, fire, and EMS. And any increase is a direct result and a decrease to services that we provide to the community in terms of public safety. So I would ask for your support of this tax, because every dollar that's saved by a local police, fire, or EMS agency is dollars that can be put forward to services to keeping our community safe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas. Carl Kennick, Oregon State Firefighters Council, and today we're here. We submitted written testimony, just a few bullet points. I'm still a working captain, paramedic, firefighter in Clackamas County, and we know, as my colleagues stated, we know more revenue for 911 means more firefighters, law enforcement, and paramedics on the street. Technology, read E911, is to get us there to the calls that are, and by doing that more efficiently, we go right where we need to go and get the right resource in the right place. Without E911, it's not there. This increase puts resources where it's needed for the public safety, I'm going to thank you in advance for your support on House Bill 2449B, and my testimony is submitted. Thanks.
I appreciate that, Carl. Questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carl Conis, Jim McCauley, Fawn Berry. Carl, sorry, didn't mean to name you twice.
Okay. Chair Haas, members of the committee, Jim McCauley representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'll make my comments very brief. We're, of course, supportive of House Bill 2449B and are hopeful that you'll be able to join us in this support for this bill to move it to the floor. This is a critical component, certainly, of community services, and with our partners that are across the state and representing 241 cities, this additional infusion of some revenue into that funding of those 911 call centers will be critically important for them in their budgetary process. I don't think there's been a week that has gone by this session where I get calls or emails from some of our partners asking the status of this 911 bill because of where their budgetary process is at, and very concerned about having to maintain that 911 service at the same time trying to take a look at staffing issues related to public safety that they also are responsible for. So I'll complete my comments with that. Please support this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Fawn Berry representing the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. We represent VoIP providers, voice over internet protocol, and have some concerns about this tax. Clearly, our members support 911 funding, and we recognize that there may be need for additional funding in the system. But with that being said, we would like to see a slower increase in this tax and like to consider, at a bare minimum, taking off the sunset extension of 8 years. We feel like this is a fairly expensive program and that it would be smart for us to take a look at how these dollars are being spent, analyze whether or not we actually have a system in place that makes the most sense in terms of the number of places that we're funding, and would like to see that discussion occur in the next interim. There has been discussion about holding some kind of a work group in the interim to have some of those discussions, but with that work group, there's still an increase of 50 cents in the bill, and there is an extension of the sunset for 8 years, which we feel like is a pretty lengthy sunset at this point in time. With that, we would just ask you to consider making some modifications to this bill, lowering the increase for now, and coming back and having this discussion in the future.
Thank you. Appreciate those comments. We have no one else signed up to testify on HB 2449, so I'm going to close out that public hearing. Thank you all. I'm going to move down our list in order and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2174. Jane, yeah.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Bill deals with urban renewal plans and the accompanying report given to the governing body of each taxing district. So in layman's terms, we in urban renewal areas that are often called blight areas, there are property tax and other tax incentives in order to help invigorate those areas. And so often what will happen is there is a before the improvements are made, the property value is frozen. And so that when the properties are improved, and in order to sort of remove the blight, the value of the property goes up. But on the roll, for local district purposes, that increased value, or what's called the incremental value, is not collected by the local taxing districts, but pulled into the urban renewal plans and the funding for those bonds and plans. And other urban renewal projects. In the case of public buildings, what happens is those same actions occur, but at the end of what is considered the normal life of those incentive programs, other properties that aren't public buildings come back onto the roll, excuse me, at their improved value. But public buildings never do that because they aren't subject to those property taxes. So you would be using urban renewal funds to generate public structures and public buildings. So what happens here in this bill is this requires, it sets up a process and a notification and also an approval period, which is, it would essentially say that the three out of the four most affected taxing districts by that urban renewal plan, that includes public buildings, would have to give their approval in order for a urban renewal plan to include public buildings that wouldn't subsequently bring tax revenue. And so then it also details some a sort of notification process and how that plan would play out.
Thank you. Mark Landauer. Mark, can you give us a picture of what the problem is we're trying to fix here?
Indeed. First of all, Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Urban renewal has been an issue for our members for many years, particularly fire districts. And the issue that this bill addresses, actually it addresses a couple of different issues, is primarily the situation that Ms. McGovern described. We've had a number of instances over the years whereby urban renewal sponsors will build or put in their plan a public building, whether it be a fire station, police station, library, city hall. Those are typically your public buildings. And as Ms. McGovern described, those buildings don't generate any property tax. And as you probably know already, the theory behind urban renewal is really to try to float all boats. And the sheer fact that you build a public building, you create debt, and that debt is very long-term. Urban renewal district typically lasts for 20 years, but the property tax that is sequestered to pay off the bonding for all the improvements that you use to address blight, the money from that property tax does not get returned to the underlying property tax jurisdictions until all the debt is paid off. Okay? Now, we did make some changes in 2009 that would allow for very successful urban renewal districts to return a portion of the property tax that is sequestered to pay off the bonding. But what this bill really attempts to do is get at the front end to give those impacted jurisdictions who are going to forego property tax anywhere from 20, 30, 40, 50 years, give them an opportunity to have a say. And one of the key ingredients to urban renewal, and it's been in place for many years, is what's called consult and confer. So when a sponsoring entity wants to create an urban renewal district, they're required to consult and confer with all the impacted jurisdictions. Well, the special districts and some other taxing jurisdictions have felt for many years that that consult and confer is really a hollow, is somewhat hollow, because really all you can do is provide advice to the sponsoring entity. With this bill, you're going to actually see a little bit of teeth. The teeth being that three of the largest four property tax recipients impacted by a public facility that is proposed under the plan get an actual say. So if you have a school district, a county, and a city, which is typically your sponsor, wanting to build a public facility, whether it be a city hall or what have you, they get to approve. And if that fourth jurisdiction says, no, you can't do that, you've got your three largest of the four, you can proceed. However, if you get two that don't want that building to be constructed, the sponsor will have to go back, redo the plan that eliminates that public facility. We think that this is a balanced approach. The bill also provides for a lot of additional information to be exchanged with the overlapping taxing jurisdictions. A great example will be, as I mentioned previously, the bonding, to pay off the bonding can take many additional years after the urban renewal plan has been completed. What this bill would require is for the sponsor to inform those entities how much debt remains and when they can have a reasonable expectation that the role will be returned back and property taxes that have been increased over the life of the urban renewal plan, when they can expect to actually receive that. This bill is a culmination of a great deal of work between the cities, the counties, school districts, OSBA, the special districts, many individual cities, as well as several fire districts that I happen to represent in this instance. It's been a very collaborative process. We've had a very good discussion over more than a year and a half. This bill actually is a culmination after 2017 when Representative Leininger actually asked us all to convene and work through some of the issues that we've been addressing. This bill is a culmination of that, and I hope that you'll look positively on it and commend it to be moved forward. And again, thank you very much, Senator Hass and members of the committee, for hearing this bill today.
Questions, Senator Riley? Okay, thank you very
much. Thank you.
Wendy Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Hass, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I participated on the same work group that Mr. Landauer did over the last year and a half. The League recommends this bill. It does curtail city's authority a bit. We are often the sponsor of an urban renewal district, but this is a balanced approach. Our work group was comprised of many economic development professionals. As you may know, urban renewal is one of our strongest tools for economic development. If you have a blighted area, you're trying to, as Mr. Landauer said, rise all boats. You pass an ordinance and mark off that area, and then the property taxes are frozen at that assessed value, and the increment above is what goes back to fund the projects. This bill would say that those projects that are public buildings that meet the definition, and it's a narrow definition, have to have approval of the taxing districts. We know that the best communities are the ones that do cooperate with their school districts, their special districts, and their counties. So this would say on those big projects, we're talking about city halls, fire stations, libraries, those kinds of things, sometimes you need a bit of the cash to make those budgets still work. They could still do them under the bill, but we'd have to get approval to do those big projects. It's a balanced approach because we recognize we're all competing for the same property tax dollars. Someday we'd love to see real property tax reform, but until then, we've got to make it work, and this tool is our most important. So it has the public body piece. It also has better year. There's an annual statement that's required of urban renewal districts. This improves that. So it's, as Mr. Landauer said, more transparent of where are we with the plan that was originally passed, where are we with the debt, and it requires our staff, or if it's not a city with staff, the representatives of the urban renewal district to meet with the public at least once a year to go over so there's transparency. I know this was an issue in rural Oregon and eastern Oregon too, of we need to know where we're at in our communities, and so it improves that. And it also just cleans up a lot of technical language that's an administrative rule but not in statute, and you have to get an urban renewal expert to even figure out what some of these plans are, the standard rate plan, the reduced rate plan, and the permanent rate plan. So it took a while in the House side to get all of that cleaned up because it's so complicated. Portland Public Schools, for example, has a special situation of their old levies and things. So this bill just cleans all that up, and we've had a lot of tax experts looking at it, and renewal experts and bond counsel looking at it for months to get it right. So we would recommend it to you. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Riley.
Thank you. I apologize. I should have asked Mr. Landauer this, because I'm going to ask you something about something he said.
Okay.
And that was in the top three, when he was talking about the top three, one of the comments was, if two of them say no, if two of them say yes of the top three, that's a go ahead. Is that correct, or?
Chair Hass, yeah, Senator Riley, the bill requires for a public project or public building, as public building is defined, that you have to have three of the four largest
approve of the public
building. If you don't have three, you would have to strike that public building project. The urban renewal district can still go forward. The other projects in the plan could go forward, but that particular public building would have to be approved.
That answered my question. I misunderstood. Thank you.
Rocky Dahlin.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlin on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. We are an association of economic development professionals, both public and private. We have cities and counties and folks at utilities and private agencies. But you've heard all the technical aspects of the bill and the process that got us here. Our folks use the urban renewal tool quite a bit. We had a great process in the interim to sit down and figure out how we can have better processes for notification, consult, and confer with the taxing districts and still use a tool that's been really valuable to many communities around the state. So we support this and hope we can get this compromise done this session. So we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Martin. That ends our witness list, clears out our witness list, and thank you, everyone. We're going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2174. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2390. Caitlin, thank you. If you could give us a summary.
Absolutely. Chair Haas, members of the committee, House Bill 2390 relates to deposits of public funds. So there are some current requirements under current public law for public funds deposits. The first is that the third party, when they are partnering with third party vendors. The first is that the third party must segregate those funds from all other funds. Second, the third party must hold the public body funds in a segregated account on behalf of the public body. And third, they must deposit the public body's funds with a qualified public funds depository. There was a work group that convened, and this bill that's before you today uses the findings from that interim work group to address some of the issues to better facilitate state interaction with third party vendors. Things that the measure does, it adds to statute new definitions related to deposits of public funds. It allows public officials to deposit funds in non-qualified depositories if amounts are deposited by or are insured by another body. It adds to statute additional ways a depository can qualify to hold public funds. It requires financial institutions holding these funds to provide evidence of collateral. And it provides the state treasurer additional flexibility in determining who can be a custodian for securities pledged by the qualified depository, and also the ability to enter into third-party agreements to better address these issues that have arisen as technology has improved. There is no revenue impact and a minimal expenditure impact, and I believe there are some people from the Treasury as well as others signed up to testify.
Yes, let's bring up the Treasury team. Ryan?
Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ryan Mann from Oregon State Treasury. Here with me is Brian Gonzalez from Treasury's Finance Division. And Legislative Revenue staff provided a very great summary of the bill. And I know you all have a lot on your plate, so I won't repeat the summary, which is largely reflected in what I had prepared to say. I would just add that this work group came out of a bill that passed in 2017, House Bill 2779, which was really just to study and develop the report that is posted on OLIS. And so some of that is the modernizing of the language in public funds law. And then the other pieces we're trying to address how state agencies and local governments work with third party vendors. And you'll see those mostly in section 29 and 30. So the members of the work group, which are listed in the report, included state agencies, local governments, banks, and credit unions, as well as our esteemed finance staff, our finance division director chaired that group, and Brian Gonzalez provided staff support as well. I would be happy to attempt to answer any of your questions. I may also defer to Brian if you all have questions of a more technical nature. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Brian.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Brian Gonzalez, Oregon State Treasury. As Ryan said, I don't have any prepared testimony, but I am happy to help address any questions you might have about the bill.
You could tell us what the task group grappled with and how this hits the mark.
Sure, Chair Haas, members of the committee. So the work group really was focused on how public bodies, both state government and local governments, interact with third-party vendors. These partnerships are to deliver governmental services, and of course we know in this time that more and more public bodies are looking to leverage technology in particular to address shorter, smaller resources.
Can you define for us third-party vendors? What's that universe?
Sure. So these are primarily financial institutions or other kind of technology providers that provide some sort of specialized software or service. So an example of that might be for state parks, for instance, they partner with a third party that provides a reservation system. So it's a system that allows campers to book a campsite. Oftentimes, these types of systems, these partnerships, include a payment component. Again, in the state parks example, that could be rental fees for the campsite. Mm-hmm. And so it's when these partnerships involve a payment component that public funds law starts becoming an issue and the various requirements that staff alluded to. And certainly over the years, we've seen an increasing number of instances where these requirements do pose challenges, in particular for state agencies, to build these partnerships. And that's primarily because these vendors often serve the nation or other jurisdictions more broadly, and yet here are asked to meet Oregon's specific legal requirements. And often that can be a challenge with their existing processes or relationships. And so really, the work group did look to these particular needs. The state has extensive experience over the last several years exploring different partnerships and understanding the kinds of issues and challenges that arise. Other members of the group that my colleague mentioned, including local governments, helped identify other challenges that other jurisdictions encounter. And really, the work group identified a handful of recommended solutions to address the issue, really hinge on additional flexibility. And so that's, again, what you'll see in Section 29 and 30 of the bill in particular, which is really just granting both the state treasurer on behalf of state agencies and then local governments themselves more flexibility in identifying alternative methods to meet public funds law requirements.
That's a good example that you use with the state parks, because I'm familiar with that state agency. They use a third-party vendor, and you give them your credit card and get your campsite or whatever. And so hypothetically, this vendor absconded with the money or went bankrupt or something, and now it has public money. So what happens in that? First of all, what happens then?
Sure. So Chair Haas, members of the committee, today the public funds law, it's important to understand, really protects laws or protects funds that are held by public depositories. And so staff mentioned that these funds have to be held either in what are we refer to as qualified depositories, meaning they participate in the collateral pool that's already contained in ORS Chapter 295, or again, those deposits are within federal insurance limits. So in other words, that ensures that funds are protected at all times. What this work group was really looking at, and the recommendation in the bill would allow, is to shift and allow an additional approach to securing funds, which is really to allow vendors to provide collateral in order to protect those funds. So again, shifting that role from, in essence, the public body's bank to now the vendor. And so the vendor would be providing collateral. A couple of different forms include cash collateral, in fact, or surety bond or a letter of credit that would really act to ensure those public funds that the third party might be holding. So again, today, in essence, under the law, third party vendors themselves don't hold the funds. They're held really by the public body in a public body's institution. Going forward, the bill would allow third parties, in essence, to hold those monies while still ensuring they're protected.
So there's that's what the certification. Where would we know that they're doing this?
So, Chair Haas, members of the committee, the alternative methods that the work group identified, again, for state agencies, the state treasurer already is the body that vets third-party vendor relationships to ensure compliance with existing requirements. The treasury would be the authorized body going forward to adopt these alternative methods. We propose to do that via policy for our state agency partners. We would continue, certainly, our review role in ensuring that these partnerships were within the requirements. And ultimately, on a go-forward or ongoing basis, I think we'd look for state agencies to continue monitoring of those relationships to ensure compliance.
How is this safer? How is this more of a safeguard for the money than a customer to the park system might, if we're putting the onus on the third-party vendor?
Sure. Chair Haas, members of the committee, I don't know that I'd say it's safer. I think I'd say it's as safe as our approach today, which is, again, working to protect these public funds. Today, that's done by making sure they're held in, again, public depositories on behalf of the public body. This would allow funds to be held by the vendor, but the collateral that would be required under the alternative methods would protect those funds as much as they are protected today. So again, it would allow greater flexibility and certainly allow public bodies, state agencies, local governments to further leverage additional technologies and benefit from those efficiencies while still protecting public funds.
Questions of these guys? Okay. Thank you both.
Brian. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Rob Babette.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties, appearing here on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers in strong support of this bill. We participated in the work group. Two things to say. One, thank you to the State Treasurer's Office for convening this group and doing an excellent job at bringing you this bill. And the second thing I'll mention, I don't think anybody's mentioned it so far, this bill comes to you without opposition from the House Revenue Committee and without opposition on the House floor. Happy to answer any questions you might have. Good bill should pass.
Questions? You know, just because bill passes the House 59-0 doesn't mean that we'll pass it. We've proven that. Bill passes over here unanimously. Believe me. Doesn't mean anything over there. I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2390 and open up a public hearing on our last bill of the day, House Bill 2587. I believe we have Rep. Meek on his way. And Jamie, can you give us a summary?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. This is House Bill 2587A makes an exception for certain homesteads of seniors, people with disabilities, prohibition of reverse mortgages for participation in the homestead property tax deferral program. This is a program where the Department of Revenue pays the property taxes for an individual that's enrolled in the program, and then upon their death or settlement of the estate, then those property taxes are paid back to that specific program in the Department of Revenue. And currently, there's a prohibition on people entering that program with the property if they have reverse mortgages on their property. And this would allow participants in the program that executed a reverse mortgage specifically between the dates of 2011 and 2017. And in addition to that, the current equity criteria is 20%, and this particular set of entrants into the program, it would require them to have a 40% equity in their house or their property.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Mark Meek, and I'm the representative from House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone, Jennings Lodge, Johnson City, and unincorporated Clackamas County. I can't leave any of them out. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 2587A. And a little bit of background, in 1963, the property tax deferral program for disabled and senior citizens since then has helped thousands of Oregonians stay in their homes by allowing them to defer their property taxes. House Bill 2587A would give more seniors and disabled Oregonians the opportunity to stay in their homes by allowing certain reverse mortgage holders back into the deferral program. The Oregon legislature made changes to the deferral program in 2011 with House Bill 2543 during the aftermath of the Great Recession. And that was done to stabilize and keep the program afloat. One of those changes was to disallow reverse mortgage holders. What House Bill 2587 will do is to, one, allow holders of reverse mortgages executed between July 1st of 2011 to January 1st, 2017 to participate in the deferral program. Reverse mortgage holders must meet all other current eligibility restrictions as well. And this is done for a couple of reasons. In 2012, the legislature passed House Bill 4039, allowing reverse mortgage holders back into the program for two more years. And B, since 2017, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development has implemented what they call a LISA, life expectancy set-aside requirements for the execution of reverse mortgages. And these two factors have created a unique situation for individuals who executed their reverse mortgage after passage of House Bill 2543 in 2011, but before HUD's new rulemaking would have precluded them from the reverse mortgage. For many of these individuals, the deferral program would have benefited them more than the reverse mortgage. And then second, this requires reverse mortgage holders to have a minimum of 40% equity in their home to be accepted into the deferral program. So during this process early on, the Department of Revenue testified in this session that since 2011, the deferral program has fully recovered and is in very strong financial health. The Oregon legislature has an opportunity this session to allow more Oregonians to age in place and keep their homes by passing House Bill 2587A. And thank you, Chair Haas.
Thank you, Rep. Meek. I know we've talked about this before, but I was on the Revenue Committee back in those years when we were trying to salvage the senior property tax deferral program. And I remember quite a bit of discussion about how reverse mortgages really were not in the best interest of those taking them out. I mean, that people could argue both ways, but that was a consensus. That's why they were eliminated. And it feels like now, with the program back on its feet, that maybe we're going back down that road. And so maybe you could explain why the limits here and why we shouldn't worry about that.
Yes, thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Very good point. And what I would love to point out is that this is not bringing any additional exposure to the program, the current health of the funds that are out there, because this is only allowing access to this program and the deferral program for those citizens that have taken that took out a reverse mortgage during the 2011 and 17 years. So we're not proliferating or even endorsing the use of a reverse mortgage. This is actually just for those folks that have already gone down that path, the opportunity to remain in their home. They took the reverse mortgage in the first place to kind of survive and live off of their limited incomes. And what I was mentioning before is that over the last every year our property taxes go up 3%. I know that's the cap, but unfortunately every year the cap is, you know, the increase is always the max 3%. But during the recession years, a lot of our folks that are on limited incomes and fixed incomes, their cost of living increase did not go up with those cost of the property taxes. So those folks that are already using the limited funds that they have in their cash flow per a monthly basis, this program would actually help them by deferring their property taxes which would not go in retroactive. It would just be these current years that they would apply for. And so they've already paid for their property taxes during those years. This would just offer for them to continue to stay in their homes and fix their allow them to use their limited income to remain in their homes. I hope that answered that a little.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. On the 40% equity part, and maybe Jamie, you could know this. What happens with eventually on a reverse mortgage? You're going backwards in equity. What if you fall below that 40%?
Senator Haas, and it's my understanding that addition to the bill, the 40%, was intended to deal with the additional 20% beyond the sort of normal equity requirement was intended to deal with that issue. It is true that the Department of Revenue, through this program, writes off approximately $500,000 per year for mortgages, reverse mortgage deferral accounts that they cannot collect upon. And so there are cases where individuals and their estates, when they are settled, don't have enough funds to pay off the property taxes. The Department of Revenue sits second in line behind the mortgage company, and it has been asked whether in another public hearing, whether there was any correlation between individuals that have reverse mortgages and who default on their program, and that isn't data that was able to be retrieved by the Department of Revenue.
Yeah, I think that's a concern, or not the concern, but the issue is this: is the mortgage company is first in line ahead of the state.
Sure, and Chair Haas, can I answer or respond to that? What's I guess very relevant to this program, the a homeowner, and the situations that probably would be relative to the estates not being able to pay their debt, would be in a situation where they may have taken a first mortgage, where their first mortgage was maxed out, and they could at that point, when they're going to their family is taking care of their estate, that's when they could be in a worse equity situation than the ones we're talking about in this program. When the folks that we're talking about, if they have 40% equity as of July 1st, 2019, or whenever this goes into place, that 40%, if we're talking a $300,000 home, is going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And if they're deferring over the next 10 years their property taxes, and say, best case, there's $6,000 a year, that's $60,000 over the next 10 years. So I'm feeling that the folks that we're talking about in this category with 40% equity would not put the fund into any major significant harm or risk. So.
Ryan?
You've covered the things that concern me. I'm not sure that we got an answer that satisfies me, but you did ask the right questions. So.
John Mullins, out of retirement.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen, and I'm working on behalf of AARP this session. But I just want to add a couple of comments to what Representative Meek said, and we did this over on the House side, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify next to him. I go way back with the deferral program. We worked with then-Senator Vern Duncan to establish the program for younger people with disabilities. And when I went to work for the Oregon Law Center, and then back in 2011, the changes that took place, because of sweeps changes in the housing market, the corpus was in jeopardy. And so many people were cut off. I then worked with then Representative Jessica Vega Peterson to work on some ideas about getting some people back into the program. And that was successful all the way throughout, and the legislature agreed. What I want to emphasize here about what Representative Meek's bill is about is it really sort of closes a historical loop that began with the cuts in 2011 and people that were added back. So this is a group of people that are time limited that did not apply for the deferral program that already had a reverse mortgage. So in essence, as I look at this, it's trying to create a little bit of historical equity for people who would have otherwise perhaps been in the program. And just in concluding, would just say in terms of AARP, we've testified on a number of housing bills this session. Affordable, accessible housing is important to our members and also for the opportunity to age in place. And this program does help people age in place. So with that, I would just say that, again, very appreciative of Representative Meek bringing this forward. And I just wanted to add a little bit of historical context.
Appreciate that. And Chair Evans, may I make one more statement before closing? And thank you very much, Chair Haas. The reason I'm even bringing this bill forward is part of my constituent outreach that I've met constituents at the door and talking to them about issues. And one of my constituents is named Gil Thomas. And he specifically reached out to me, kind of letting me know his plight. And he is one of the few that was not able to take advantage of this and is basically just trying to survive off of his, you know, limited monthly income. And his family or himself are trying to remain in their home based on their limited, you know, resources. To me, it's a very valuable program in which we could actually support more folks to remain in their homes. I know that their alternative is they could sell their home and live in an apartment or something like that. But as anybody knows, when you have lived in your home or property, changing your surroundings, you know, at any time in your life is very difficult. So I just think this is a very, very thoughtful process in which I think within the budgeting process and remaining solvent that we can allow a few, and there's a select few that are even eligible for this, to participate in the program if they still need it. And I think it would be a great way to let some of our other families that are in that same situation participate. So I appreciate your consideration for this very much, and thank you. Thank you. Appreciate you guys coming forward. Thanks. All right, I'll close out the public hearing on House Bill 2587. And that clears our docket for today. Thank you, committee. We'll see you back here at 3 o'clock tomorrow. We're adjourned.